And our last speaker, not last but not least, of course, speakers, are Anne-Marie Willer and Alice Carley. Anne-Marie Willer has been the Preservation Librarian at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology since 2006. She was previously the Preservation Librarian at the University of North Texas and the Bindery Supervisor at Sibley Music Library. She currently serves as Chair of the Preservation and Reformatting Division of the American Library Association and is Chair of the Advisory Committee for NEDCC, Northeast Document Conservation Centre. In addition to a Master's degree in Library Science, she has a BA in Music, an MA in Musicology, and a Graduate Certificate in Preservation Management, and is a former classical double bassist, so very interested in the preservation of audiovisual materials. Alice Carley is the Scores Conservator at the Sibley Music Library. Over the past 20 years she's been there, she's seen the department move very strongly towards digital preservation, but does want to reiterate that paper conservation is still an important item there as well. So I'd like to welcome them both up to the podium.
To start, Anne-Marie and I both realized we wanted to know a little bit more about our audience before we started speaking to everybody. So I'm going to take a little survey. With a show of hands, how many here today work with institutional collections? Lots, all right. And how many with a personal collection? Okay. Yes. I should have had people raise both hands if it was both, but anyway. A lot of this demo is actually my demo, which I will be kind of in the middle of what Anne-Marie is doing, is aimed at home collectors because I'm hoping that most professional sound conservation people know a lot of this stuff already or have the facilities available, so that I'm sort of doing a Julia Child presentation here for home collectors in my section, but it never hurts to see an overview anyway. And then, what sort of collections are people working with? LPs. All right, 78s. Yeah. Cylinders. All right. Tapes of any sort. Yeah. CDs. Piano rolls. Wire recordings, is there anything else I'm missing? All right, wow.
A film.
Film, okay. And in fact, yeah, I was including that with the tapes, but that's a different... how many people have recordings that have... Actually, no, I'm going to come back to that question. I think it is time for me to turn this over to Anne-Marie, who's going to talk about a particular collection in her care.
So we're very pleased, Alice and I, to be here talking to you this afternoon in what we're calling Sound Preservation 2.0, or what to do with the non-AV primary source materials in your recorded sound collections. As you know, sound collections often contain non-audiovisual materials. These might be a concert program tucked into a box with a reel of tape, a paper insert inside a cassette box, or even an accompanying script, transcription, or score. These materials provide valuable context and provenance information for the sound recordings. These are boxes, labels, paper files. They're all primary sources, but they have different preservation needs than the audiovisual items in your collections. So our joint presentation first focuses on the a case study that helps us to explore the importance of the paper-based materials. We'll use MIT's Kenneth Hale collection as our example. Kenneth Locke Hale lived from 1934 to 2001. He was a key figure in the study of endangered languages and cultures, and he was actively involved in causes promoting their preservation. The Hale Collection, which is housed in the MIT Institute Archives and Special Collections, consists of over 200 cubic feet of material dating from the 1950s to 2000. The most fragile materials in the collection are the approximately 600 audio cassettes and reel-to-reel tapes of linguistic sessions that Hale recorded with peoples from around the world. As you might expect with fieldwork recordings, the tapes had a fairly dusty start to life and probably experienced periods of less than ideal temperature and humidity. I was concerned that the content of these tapes might be lost due to damage that they experienced along their journey. Last year, however, the MIT libraries worked with a vendor to transfer content from 46 tapes as part of a pilot project. And so given that success, I think that we will be able to transfer and recover all of Hale's careful and detailed work from the tapes. In fact, right now, the MIT Libraries Development Officer is reaching out to private donors who may wish to participate in funding a project to reformat the remaining tapes and also process the archival collection. The Hale collection also includes correspondence, project files, course teaching materials, writings, field notes, and transcriptions, as well as a quite large reference collection of articles, papers, vocabularies, dictionaries, word lists, and background materials related to a multitude of languages. These are the kinds of things that today's researchers might have in Evernote, but that Kenneth Hale, of course, had in paper files. All of these non-audiovisual materials provide really important context for Hale's work, and many of the documents are critically necessary to help us decipher the content of these unique field recordings. Here, for example, is a series of index cards recording Walpiri words. Walpiri is the Australian indigenous language that Hale focused on for his doctoral dissertation. And then later throughout his career, he moved to focus on languages throughout the world, but he did maintain a primary focus in Australia and also the American Southwest. On this slide, I zoomed in on one of the index cards. This is the index card for choke and its various uses, and you can see, you probably can read his handwriting, it says, don't choke on it, and the dust chokes me, as well as the Walpiri words, which I won't pronounce for you. Ken Hale was known for his fastidiousness in taking notes and recording his field activities. His attention to detail makes this collection an especially unique and valuable resource. And because the recordings are of languages that most of us, all of us, don't speak, we are completely dependent upon Hale's notes to identify and understand the content of each recording. In this first recording, you'll be able to tell that the man is singing a song, but that's about all we can know. You would have a hard time figuring out the content and the value of the tape. So if we could hear example one, just about 15 seconds or so. Thank you. This next recording is much easier to understand because it actually contains some English. If we could hear example two.
Kanyano Yirani Mukadi Churu Kura. My two brothers each put their hats on. My brother put his shoes on. My two brothers each put their shoes on.
Thank you. Get a little taste of his methodology there as well. So in that case, I think the content's really easy to understand, but only a few of his tapes actually have English on them. So thankfully, Dr. Hale applied a numbering system to his tapes, and he cross-referenced his field notes and transcriptions using these numbers. As you might expect, we would be lost without these numbers. There's very little English in the files as well. Dr. Hale labeled each physical recording or box, but as you know, labels sometimes pop off the box, and reels get switched around. So in addition to labeling, Hale usually took time at the beginning of the tape to speak the tape number, the date, the interviewee, and the subject. Could we hear example three, please?
Tape 2.18, further utterances in Warpi, spoken by Sam Johnson, Tapangadi, Yundumu. Six. The following is a dialogue about buying at the canteen.
Thank you. Wouldn't that be wonderful if all your recordings had something like that at the beginning? That would be amazing. So that obviously makes it a lot easier to work with the recordings, and particularly because it's an indigenous language with which we're not familiar, it's really critical. What's really even more wonderful is when the number on the tape box not only matches the number in the field notes, but also matches documentation such as this transcription. If you could play the fourth audio example, please.
The following are additional utterances in Walbri, spoken by Stephen Simpson, Tapangadi, Warabri. Further notes on certain grammatical features. Nerpakan guluwanga maninjarangi.
Maninjarangi kana luwanga. Yang gula kana luwanga pa lang jalamani. Jarang kana lutan ngajuk.
Thank you very much. You might have been able to follow along a little bit there. So with Hale's verbal labels at the start of the tape, plus the written labels on the transcription, you're well ahead of the game in trying to get a handle on this content. The Hale collection also contains letters, maps, cards, and other non-AV material, all kinds of things, as you might expect. And all are part of telling the story around these recordings. The Kenneth Hale collection is a very clear example of non-audiovisual primary source material that's crucial to our understanding of the audio portions of the collection. And its importance is underscored by the fact that the language on the tapes, of course, as I've said, is unfamiliar and therefore undecipherable without the documentation. Of course, many recorded sound collections don't include such voluminous paper files and documentation such as the Hale does. All that may be available is a little label on the reel, or scribble on the box, or that little slip of paper that somebody tucked inside. In many ways, these are even more critical to preserve than Dr. Hale's files. Even if, for example, you have English language tapes, maybe oral histories, they still might be hard to understand. The voices might not be recognizable, or they might not be very distinct, or the content may be just unknown to you. If it's a music recording, it's probably impossible to figure out who the performer is and what the venue is. So every scribble, every note, is a clue to understanding those recordings. It's important to protect those bits of information. Paper-based materials have different storage and conservation requirements than AV formats. And so Alice will now give you some tips in the next section of our presentation.
This around this way, yes, so that I can do some speaking while working at the table. Let's see. Okay, that is sort of, once again, this is more aimed towards home conservation. Now I have a couple more questions. How many people have collections with voluminous paper material attached, like the Hale collection? All right. I'm actually going to be somewhat, you've probably dealt with them already in various ways institutionally. How many people have, I'm going to take an instance, a disaster plan for your institutional collection. How many people have a disaster plan for your home collection? Yeah, one. Oh, there we go, another half a hand up. And that is getting at what I decided I wanted to focus on. There's a difference between what you do at work and what you do at home, even when it's kind of the same thing. And part of it is all the facilities that you have in a highly supported organization or institution versus, you know, you got your dining room table or whatever. How many people keep their home collections in special purpose-built, specially HVAC'd areas? That's also what I thought. How many people have had to deal with damp, mustiness, or mold? I kind of thought that too. So good. Then I have looked at some of the right things here. I will make a handout available to anyone who signs a sheet that might as well go around. Or that gets in touch with me. I'm at Sibley Music Library. If you use Jim Farrington's email address, only put A. Carley in front of it instead of J. Farrington, it will come to me. But I wanted to actually do the talk first to kind of, again, find out what the audience is. Okay, I want to talk then briefly about paper materials in home collections in particular. First, storage conditions. Obviously a good rule, and I think you probably already understand this, is to keep your collections in the main living area of the house. Everybody will like that except your spouse. I can tell you that right now. My husband is the collector. That way, if the heat or the humidity rise to dangerous levels, the chief danger being mold, you know it. And everybody is motivated to do something about it, like getting the air conditioner fixed or getting the leak fixed. Getting the air conditioner fixed is the main way to combat mold. The main cause of mold problems in home collections is having them tucked away in the attic or the basement where you don't notice the water leak for a month and a half. The more likelihood there is of dampness in your storage area, the more important, obviously, it is to check in often on the stored collections. And you already know that. And I know that sometimes there is no choice about where you will be storing collections, especially records. They're heavy. They can end up in the basement. And you will also be storing them, most likely. I'm going to start moving some things over this way. In proximity to paper. The problem is paper attracts and holds water. So that when things get damp, when things get damp, the paper takes longer to dry than the recorded material does. So that the paper, you know, if this had gotten wet, you know, if we dropped the water on it, you could take the disc out, and it would be dry faster than the paper would. The paper is what is most likely to get moldy. Once again, the main way to combat this is don't get it wet in the first place. Keep your stuff someplace where it's going to stay dry. And I am mostly for this. I'll have more in the handout about that. But for this, I'll just say, let's just assume that you're doing that. Assume that you've got an air conditioner, etc. A few things to note particularly then about paper things. First, I think everybody knows you are supposed to take the records out of the flimsy inside paper covers that they come with and use, this is LPs, and use some of the various LP sleeves that are recommended for this. And the first, there's a, I am not a recordings conservator, I am a paper conservator, so anytime I say anything about recordings conservation, some of you may know better about that than me, but hey, that LP sleeve site looked good to me and seemed to be saying that most recordings people do agree that getting LPs out of acidic paper and deteriorating plastic is a really good idea. And some of those sleeves, you can stick them back into the rigid box. You kind of like the rigid boxes. I'm calling this a box. The jackets, partly because they are rigid, and for an LP, you need that added protection, and partly because there's an awful lot of information about the record on it. And there are LP sleeves to accommodate that. It's also, in fact, okay to keep most recordings in their original boxes, or whatever they are, boxes they arrived in, with either the publisher's information or those invaluable little scribbles on them. Except you don't want to keep wax cylinders in the original flocked boxes, and you probably already know that because the flocking is really great at keeping mold going or getting it started, and that's why so many wax cylinders have mold problems. Don't keep them in flocked boxes. You can keep them on spindles or whatever. Again, I think people mostly know that. And for 78s, heavy paper covers are typically used, and unlike LPs, the information on 78s is buried deeper in the grooves so that you don't have to worry so much about scratching them as you do with LPs, that being one of the reasons you don't want paper sleeves for LPs. Also, I mean, this is an Edison disc, it's really rigid, but in general, 78s can support their weight and so forth, so that a heavy paper cover is enough. And finally, you can write on the corners of the papers so that you can tell where the top edge is, and you can don't have to pull it all the way out in order to find out what's on the record. This does, of course, presuppose that you are the kind of person who, when you take an not LP, take a 78 out of the sleeve and play it, you put it back in the same sleeve it came out of. This sleeve says, "My Blue Heaven, What Do We Do?" And the record says, "Isn't She the Sweetest Thing?" You know yourself, either put little markers on or not accordingly. Further on materials. More on paper in general. Here is a score from the Sibley Music Library. It was published in 1959. That means it's on acidic paper. Mid-1980s was when paper mills started going into non-acidic paper. But it's looking very nice. I want to demonstrate the standard brittleness test for paper, called the two-fold test. You fold a corner over, and you fold the corner back over the other way, and if it falls off like that, then the paper is brittle. So this nice looking score has failed the two-fold brittleness test. As a matter of fact, its 1959 paper cover failed too. That tells us two things. First, that it's worth buying storage materials that will last and that won't produce acidic gases as they age. So for all of those accompanying paper materials, here is a binder that we use for music that is mostly a sample of buffered binders board. The white side of the board does actually have calcium carbonate kind of added into it so that it will actually absorb acids as they are produced, which they will be by paper as it continues to slowly deteriorate, because paper does that. Here's a sample of a portfolio binder that will hold a number of pieces of paper. I don't really like them so much because you have to open them so much when you use them. You can also make pocket binders and so forth. That's sort of an idea on materials. The second thing is that this means that nearly every piece of paper in your collection probably either is brittle already or soon will be if it dates from before about 1985. And the bad news is that you can't make it better by deacidifying the paper because the damage is already done. So you can go ahead and deacidify it and keep it from getting worse if you want to. But you will in any case need to take good care of your older papers. Rigid coverings like that help keep them upright on shelves, keep them from slumping over, and also keep them from getting ripped up. And for the invaluable little scribbled notes that are tucked in with cassettes and reel-to-reels or in, you know, in the middles of cylinders that don't have the titles printed on the top, as long as they're in whatever rigid box is holding your recording, and as long as they're not folded up, maybe it doesn't matter if they get a little brittle. If they are big enough to fold, particularly, you might want to consider recopying them onto acid-free paper, which is any good quality photocopy paper nowadays, so that the next time you take one out, you can consider doing that if you want. I had mentioned mold before, and now I want to come back again to it and say that your most important piece of equipment relating to mold is an air conditioner or a dehumidifier if you don't have a window in your, you know, depends on what kind of area you're storing things in. The first thing to do if you start to smell mustiness in a storage area is to whip out your dehumidifier and plug it in and run it and empty it until the musty smell goes away, which it will do when the mold plants die. For how many people is this all familiar old hat? And more about mold. Okay, more about mold. Mold plants have mycelia, which is kind of, you could think of it as the roots of the mold plant. And that is what sticks down into whatever the mold is growing on and does the actual eating of cellulose or wax or even some kinds of plastic. And that causes the smell and that causes the pitting that damages the recording quality. And that cannot be repaired because that is wax or whatever that has been eaten. Mold also has the little tiny stems that stick up and make the fuzz, and those are what produce the mold spores. If you do forget to check on your collection for a while and you miss that first musty smell, which is your first warning and is the chance to plug in your dehumidifier and if the musty smell subsequently goes away, you can breathe a sigh of relief and say, okay, I'm done for the moment. But if it doesn't, or if you come across something that you haven't checked and you see the little fuzziness, then you need to do something. If you see it on the boxes, and it's just the boxes, because remember, the paper tends to grab the water first, so it's likely to mold first, then you may not be too late to save the sound, but you need to get cracking.
I'm going to do something. If you're at home, that means...
It came this way to us.
that is in a moldy box. When you find a moldy box like this, the first thing you want to do, besides turning on your dehumidifier and putting on your stuff, is to take it outside. Mold is everywhere outside. You won't damage anything outside. So go outside, get yourself a nice table like this, and open the box. And take a look at whatever it is that was in the box. In this case, ooh, look at that. This is something we're not going to keep. You can see that there is mold damage on this. If this were, say, a cylinder or a disc or whatever else, if it was in nice shape and it was only the box that was moldy, which might well be the case, again, because paper goes first, set it aside. You know, maybe you can even, you can take it back inside, but like put it in your kitchen. Put it somewhere, you know, don't put it back in your collections room yet. Down under mold cleaning here, that first thing, and again, I'll send these around to people, so don't worry about that, is a what looked like it was a pretty good thing on cleaning reporting media. And again, you know better than I do about this, but from everything I know about paper media and conservation in general, it looked good. The next one is about cleaning mold from paper. And for cleaning mold from paper, which you don't want to do for your recordings, let me just underline that one more time. What you want to do is use, you can, nowadays what's recommended is vulcanized rubber sponges, which are now, you can get them from Gaylord, which is one of the archival groups. Now this is, I think this we're going to say, I wouldn't even keep this. This can be replaced. Anything you can replace, replace it.
I want to keep it.
Okay. You can keep it. But you can use this rubber sponge. See how it's got black stuff on it now? That's the mold residue. You will want to have, and this is something that I have not done now, and I'm not going to go further on this right now because the next thing you would want to have already done is put this not in its box. Anything that you want to keep and clean, including paper like this, in a room with a dehumidifier going for a week. And at the end of that week, you should no longer see anything that looks fuzzy like this. What you should instead see is stuff that looks dusty. You'll want to use the sponge to get all the dust off. And as you work, you want to, let's see, my scissors over there, I'll find them later, kind of snip off the dust, the black edges of the sponge, and just keep on working. You can, again, you can buy these sponges and you'll just go through them. They are disposable. Everything having to do with mold is disposable. And then once you have gotten off all of that dust, you want to take some cheesecloth. I am going to need my scissors. There they are. And some 70% alcohol. And interestingly, 70% is was recommended by the Cornell people who did that site, which is up there, over 91% alcohol. Beg your pardon?
What type of alcohol?
They said either isopropyl or ethanol. They actually recommended isopropyl because, anyways. Whatever your supermarket has on sale for that, it's because it is toxic, obviously. In fact, it is toxic to the mold. It's another reason for doing it outside. Of course, it is toxic for you. But you want to get it wet with the alcohol and let it dry again. And the other thing it will do is provide a last bit of desiccation for the paper. And once you have got everything that was moldy wet and then dry again with the wet with the alcohol and then dry again, you can consider it to be clean. And you can take it and put it in a, in this case, new box, and put it back on your shelves. And as long as your shelves stay dry, you don't have to worry. For anything, if things get damp, it'll mold again. And anything that has once been moldy will get moldy again, even faster than before, because the alcohol will kill the last remaining bits of the mold mycelia, the plants. It'll kill mold spores. It's very difficult and toxic, and about impossible, to kill mold spores, which are, in any case, everywhere. So that don't set yourself to try to kill all mold spores. Instead, just keep your stuff dry. This box, I would obviously toss, except that I would, since the label is in pretty nice shape. Want a second? Soak off the label. And I'll say just a couple words about soaking and other kinds of conservation and repairs.
Alice, if the box is of artifactual value.
If the box is of artifactual value, you can do the same kind of paper mold reduction, that is, do the same stuff.
But would you isolate the two previously moldy components?
Not as long as I have them clean. I put them back together. But you would first store them for a week and in dehumidify them separately with lots of airflow for a week to kill the mold first. And then you would remove it. And there we go. You're supposed to take the gloves off inside out. There. Box I made this morning. having finally taken the time to decide how to make new boxes, and in the handout I will show how you can make boxes fairly easily if you want to and if you don't want to spend the money buying boxes. Again, resources are a difference. Here's the tub in which I would soak. Soak that moldy label. Pretend this was full of water instead of other stuff. You want to soak it for at least half an hour, or preferably until the label just floats off on top of the water. Unlike recordings, paper really doesn't mind water. It kind of likes it as long as it's not getting moldy and as long as you soak the whole thing. You get water stains if you soak part of a piece of paper and all of the brown stuff that's been in the paper floats to the edge of the puddle of water and makes a watermark. This is assuming, of course, that you've got paper that doesn't have water-soluble ink on it.
Any particular kind of water? Just tap water?
If you know what your tap water is, go ahead and you think it's not. I would say if you're not sure, go ahead and use buy distilled water. But in fact, water with more minerals in it is probably better for the paper than water with less minerals in it on the whole. But I've been trying to find anything about stuff you can add to distilled water to make it really good and paper friendly, and I have not yet been able to find that. It's one of the things that I want to find and put in that handout and haven't. And I'm surprised by that, and I'm trying to find out why. But for the moment, it works fine to use filtered or distilled water, and you know that you're not adding anything to the paper that way in any case. Paper finds water relaxing. I actually already relaxed this side this morning by spraying a little bit of water on it and then putting it between two pieces of blotter paper. And then putting the blotter paper between two pieces of melamine board, which are a great paperweight and pretty cheap. And again, you can get them at your local hardware store. I didn't leave myself enough time to say too much about tape and glue. I'm going to leave the glue off altogether, although I was kind of pleased with those. They came out very nicely. Every once in a while, you know, even in the best run places, paper tears. Don't do this, please. Don't use cellophane tape, obviously. And note that when paper tears, it almost never tears, you know, like straight through. It's always beveled. You can really see it clearly here. See that white edge of the paper? That's because it's the middle of the paper. So be very careful when you put the paper back together. Actually, usually paper bevels enough that if you have a little tiny glue brush and a little bit of glue, you can glue it back together. And it will be as strong as any tape repair you can do. But you do have to dry it under a weight and with like wax paper to keep the glue from getting all over the place, so it's a little messy. So usually it's simpler to buy tape. We use Filmoplast, which you can get at Gaylord. The other paper tape that's commonly used is Lineco, which a lot of people may be familiar with for home use because it's sold at a lot of art stores. It's a little bit heavier and less transparent than Filmoplast, so for anything with text on it, I'd go with the Filmoplast. For piano rolls, the Lineco is fine. And I think I am out of time and should head back to head this back to Anne Marie, and then you can ask us both questions at the end. But I'm going to quietly put things away while she's finishing up.
So after you followed Alice's advice and done your best to protect the non-AV materials in your recorded sound collection, then you want to be sure and keep the media and the non-media connected in some way so that the paper materials can continue to provide that context for the audio. So proximity is one way, maybe the easiest way. That's the way we most of us do it. We fold up the concert program or put the note in there and just slip it in with the recording. And in many cases, that's okay. And Alice's recommendation to transfer some of those items to acid-free paper, particularly if they're folded, is the way to go. So you do want to give those items special attention so that they don't get damaged or separated or lost. At MIT, we're a big institution. We have access to a media storage facility at the Harvard Depository. So for audiovisual materials that are in mixed archival collections, such as the Hale collection, we store the AV materials in cooler conditions than the accompanying paper files and transcriptions. So they're in separate rooms, so we can't use proximity to link those items together. Instead, staff members from the MIT archives process the collection and either create finding aids or link items using an archival data management system called Archivist Toolkit. And in the case of the Hale collection, because Dr. Hale was so meticulous, there's plenty of tape numbers and other reference points to help us link the AV and non-AV materials. For smaller collections, AV and non-AV items don't necessarily need to be separated. I wouldn't expect anyone to do that, for example, with their home collection. You can keep things together. So this pamphlet and this 78 are cataloged so that they stand next to each other on the shelf. And you might be able to tell or guess that the sleeve is an archival sleeve and the pamphlet, accompanying pamphlet, is put into an archival pamphlet binder. So both are well protected. You can also group your items together in an envelope or a box, again, preferably archival, or tie them together with cotton tying tape. There's a lot of simple, low-tech ways to connect items. And of course, I would recommend against rubber bands because they do get sticky and dry over time. So stay away from those. And of course, you can use software like the Archivist Toolkit to catalog your collection and create links between items, but a simple spreadsheet or database using standard issue office software will do the same thing. In most cases, all you really need is to have a key, or what Microsoft Access calls the primary key. That's how it links tables, but to have some sort of key that links items is the way to keep those things connected. So this might be a number like Hale's tape number, or a randomly generated